Pleasure to be with you tonight. I'm going to try to speak from down here because tonight's lesson, as well as the next three lessons, are more of a learning opportunity. We want to learn some things as opposed to a formal sermon that you normally hear. And tonight I want to give you kind of an introduction to the land of Israel. And I'm going to present my material, and then at the end I'm going to we'll have an invitation. And after the invitation song, I'm going to come back up, and for 5 or 10 minutes, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have. And so, if you have any, feel free to think about it, and if not, we'll go on our merry way. But I want to tell you a little bit about me. I had a couple of people this morning ask me, well, how did you get started doing this? What's the background? Well, let me just touch on that just for a second. Back in 2006, my parents made a trip with Farrell Jenkins. Some of you may know him. He lives in Temple Terrace, Florida. Made a trip with him on a tour to go over to Israel. And as soon as they got back, they called me on the phone. They said, Barry, you really need to go over there. Well, at the time, Tabitha and I had small kids. It just really wasn't feasible for us to go. In 2008, my sister, Barbara Jo, and her husband, Nor, some of you live here locally, some of you may know them, they made a trip. And when they came back, they said, wow, Mary, you really need to go over there. And we'll keep your kids. And so that was kind of the ticket we needed. And so in 2010, Tabitha and I went over there. And I think the reason my parents and my sister called me immediately when I got back was because they knew how much I loved God's Word. And they knew how much I loved geography. And knew how much I loved travel. And so this was kind of the perfect marriage of all that. And so we went over, and in 2010, we made our first trip over there. Here, Tabitha and I standing at the watchtower at the ancient city of Hazor, north of the Sea of Galilee. And I'll tell you that I have never in my life really doubted my faith. With that being said, this trip had a profound impact on me. To be able to walk in the places where so many of the events took place just affected me more than I thought it would. And so, immediately after returning in 2010, I said, well, I need to go back. And so, I went back again on one of Farrell Jenkins' trips in 2012. And it was during that trip when I decided I would love to lead tours like this. And so, I actually made 2 different trips to Temple Terrace and sat down across the desk from Mr. Jenkins. And he very patiently answered hundreds of questions that I had about a lot of this. And so I decided in 2014 to give it a try, and I instantly fell in love with it. We actually have a few people in the audience tonight that were on that took a gamble and that were with me on that 2014 tour. And so I did that, and I led a tour in 2014, I led another tour in 2015. I had no plans on leading a tour in 2016, however an opportunity that most of y'all are aware of came up with a small group of Christians called Happy Media. And we actually ended up going over there in 2016 and filming 5 episodes of a series called Following the Messiah. And we went to the places that Jesus lived. So we did that in 2016. In 2017, we went back, filmed 5 more episodes, and also had another tour in 2017. And then the same thing happened this year in 2018. I went over there for 2 weeks in May to film the 5 episodes of our next series, Searching for a King. The period of the United Kingdom. And then I went back in July leading a tour. And so I've been over there about 9 times in the last 8 years. And every time I go, I learn more and more. There's just so much to learn. And not a day goes by, not an hour goes by that I'm over there where I don't learn something. So here's a few pictures. This is actually a picture from the tour in 2014. You may recognize a couple of those people in there because they're actually sitting in this audience. So here we are on the Mount of Olives. This is me standing in front of the aqueduct at Caesarea Maritima. We'll talk about Caesarea a little bit more tomorrow night, I believe. Here we are at Caesarea Philippi, and I'm talking to the people there about the events of Matthew 16, which Jesus talks to his disciples, and Peter declares that Jesus is the Son of the living God. Here's the team, as I said, the team from Happy Media. And those of you who traveled with me before recognize the 2 gentlemen that are squatting down in front. One of the best ways to travel over there is to have friends. And I've got some really, really, really good friends over there. The gentleman on the left, his name is Gus. He's a Palestinian Christian. He's raised in the Catholic faith. And he's the guy that I hire. Every time I go over there, I hire him. He's absolutely fantastic. He speaks five languages. The guy on the left, his name is Fauzi. He is the driver that I hire. He is a Palestinian, lives in the old city. He's a Muslim. These two men are some absolute, I'm a guy who can say this, sweetest men I've ever met. They will do absolutely anything for you. And it's just amazing how kind and these people are. Here's a group of mine out by the Mediterranean Sea. What you can't see in this picture is a big sign that says, "Do not approach the water." But adults are just like kids. If there's water, you can't keep them out of it. And so here they all are, dipping their feet in the Mediterranean Sea. This is me talking to the group on the southern steps of the Temple Mount. And I'm describing to them what they're seeing around. And this was taken in 2017. Here's the four of us. We actually took my older son, Jacob, back in 2014. And last year, we were privileged enough to be able to take our two younger kids over. Here we are on the Mount of Olives, of course, with the old city of Jerusalem in the background. And so that's kind of what I do. I have a full-time job. I'm a software developer. I work on a NASA contractor, like so many other people around here. But between 4 p.m. and midnight, I do this kind of stuff. And so it's a joy. I love it. It's a very time-consuming hobby at this point, but I really do love it. And I love teaching other people about the lands of the Lord. And that's what we want to kind of do over the next four lessons, is kind of teach you about some things, so hopefully you'll be better students of the Bible yourself. Now, before I start, I want to answer three questions. And these are three questions that I found that people have in their minds, but they're too afraid to ask. But they're thinking about it. And so let's just get these questions out of the way so that we can concentrate on what we need to concentrate on. Now, these questions don't even have anything to do with the Bible, actually. But they're questions that little kids have, that older kids have, that older adults have. But let's just address them. The first one is, what languages do they speak in Israel when we travel over there? Well, they speak primarily Hebrew, Arabic, and English. Those of us in the United States have a different impression of languages. There's actually a joke over in Israel, and that is, what's the name of someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. You speak three languages, trilingual. What if you speak one language? You're an American. And that's sadly true. That's sadly true. And quite frankly, those of us in Alabama, we haven't mastered truly the one language. But we're supposed to have mastered very well as well. But obviously the Jewish people speak Hebrew, the Palestinian, the Arab people speak Arabic, and of course there's a lot of English spoken over there, just mostly because of tourism. I speak a couple of words of Hebrew, no Arabic, but I've really never had any problems. If you hold up a Magnum bar and you're not sure, chocolate is kind of a universal word. You can kind of figure out what you want to buy if you need to. But I can travel out and see pictures like this. This is a gas station over there. Of course, this is outside the Jewish town of Beersheba. You see Hebrew written on here. For those of you who are math wizards and would like a math assignment tonight, the price that you see on there is shekels per liter. Of course, we have our prices in dollars per gallon, so you can go home tonight and figure out how much they're paying for gas. It's probably not what you would expect, to be honest with you. But this is a sign in the gas station. This is a sign outside of the theater at Caesarea. And what you see there, of course, is Hebrew on top, Arabic in the middle, and English on the bottom. It's very common everywhere to see signs like this. Here's a street sign, same thing, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And so, it's usually not a problem to get to where you want to go, even if you don't speak Hebrew or Arabic. The second question is what kind of food do they have in Israel? Well, I will tell you, I'm actually a pretty picky eater, and I'll say they have very good food. I have never had any problem finding food that I like, with the exception of, what do you guess? Pork. Yeah, bacon. Of course, the consumption of pork is against Jewish and Muslim law. So there are a few places, emphasis on few, in which you can get some ham over there. But for the most part, you go pork-free for 2 weeks when you travel over there. Usually my first stop between the airport and my house is Law Department. Because I got to get that going back in my system. I'm starting to have some withdrawal effects. But and you don't realize how much pork you actually eat until you're actually brought into a scenario in which there is no pork available. But here's a salad bar at one of the restaurants we eat at. A salad is very big, especially at breakfast. Can't eat a lot of salads for breakfast. Some of the best fruit I've ever eaten has been over there. There's a fruit tray over there. And of course, you can see cherries and this is dates over here to the left. If you've never had a date, it's very, very good, very sweet. A lot of good fruits over there. They do have some things over there that are recognizable. Here's a Coke can, of course, written in Arabic on the side. And they have some things, unfortunately, that are very recognizable. Here's a menu actually from McDonald's, and as you see, both the Hebrew and Arabic languages are read right to left. And so that's why you can see this over here. Here's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They go from right to left. And remember, this is all part of Jewish law. So you can eat a hamburger over there, but it's really hard to find a custom of cheeseburger. Because it's against Jewish law to have cheese and meat in the same dish. So you can get a hamburger, but it's very difficult to get a cheeseburger. Same way with a pizza. Like, for instance, most of the pizzas over there will have vegetables on them. They won't have meat on them, which I don't like because I really like meat on pizza. But I will tell you that if you go to a pizza place and they fix their own dough and their own tomato sauce and their own cheese, you can make a really, really good pizza. If you're hand-cooking, hand-making all that stuff. So that's the kind of food that they have over here. The third question, this is one I get all the time. Is it safe to travel in Israel? The answer to that is yes. And I have to be real careful when I answer this because I don't want to sound sarcastic. Because there's almost an implication in the question that I would ask people to go somewhere that is not safe. Which is not true. I've never asked anybody to go to somewhere that's not safe. I don't lead tour to the south side of Chicago. It's not safe to go there. But Israel is actually very safe. The only time I've actually felt nervous when I've been traveling over there was the year that Levon was with me. And actually, I was nervous because of the Israelis, not necessarily us, because I'd taken Levon. There's no telling what he might do when we're over there. But it's incredibly safe to travel over there. But I understand why the question is asked so much. The question is asked so much because you've seen things like this on the news. There'll be a 30-second soundbite, and this is the kind of picture that you see. Or you'll see a picture like this. People rioting in the streets and things like that. First of all, you've got to remember that the news departments are in the business of the money. And bad news sells out, raises viewership and things like that. This is not the way it is over there. I was actually in Israel back in 2016 when the mass shooting happened in Orlando, if you remember that. There was a nightclub and there was a shooting there. And Israeli media is just like our media. If you were to watch that, which we did, you would get the impression that that's what it's like all over the United States. And of course, we all recognize that was an unfortunate incident in one small locale. I mean, it wasn't representative of the entire city of Orlando. It's just something that happened, unfortunate. It's not representative of everything that's going on. Same thing is over there. When you see something, it's usually such a small thing, and it usually lasts a really short time over there. But the news departments are trying to tell you bad news. They don't like to report good news like this. They don't talk about people praying. Let me tell you, if you want to pray openly, you go to Israel. You don't need to be embarrassed about it over there. In fact, if you're not praying openly, you're in the minority. I took this picture one morning at the Western Wall. What you see here is some young boys praying at the Western Wall. It took about 7:15 in the morning, and what's happening there is that part of their secular education is to teach their young boys how to pray. Before math, before reading, all that, you teach your kids how to pray. Now, I may disagree with this group of people on some religious issues, but I tell you what, as a parent, there's a lesson I can learn there. Get your priorities right. And it's such a powerful thing. But the news doesn't report about that. They don't report about things like that. They don't report about the sunrise on the Sea of Galilee. A lot of you know where we live out on McCully Mill Road. Our house faces east. There's a cotton field. Actually, soybeans this year. Cotton field right across the road. Sun comes up. Stunning. Sunrises are beautiful everywhere. But I tell you, when you watch the sunrise over the Sea of Galilee, it is absolutely beautiful. News doesn't report things like that. The news doesn't report about the bumper wheat, you know, wheat harvest that they have every year. Agriculture is huge. You wouldn't believe the things that are going on there. And I took this on the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley. Wheat fields just growing like crazy. This is really, really bright. You might be able to see here, there's a top peak right here of a mountain. This is Mount Hermon on the northern end of Israel, over 9,000 feet in elevation, huge skews over the top. News doesn't report about the opening of ski season. One of the things they don't do. So, is it safe to travel over there? Absolutely. It's completely unsafe to travel over there. Usually the people that travel with me, at some point in the trip, they'll come up to me and they'll say, "Wow, this is nothing like what I thought it was." And I say, "Yeah, I know." The truth of the matter is that the people over there are just like us. They get up in the morning, the little kids put on their Spider-Man backpacks, and they walk to school. Parents are out working, trying to earn money to feed their kids, put clothes on their kids, things like that. A lot of things that we can relate to. And they just live in a different part of the world. And I really, really enjoyed getting to know a lot of these people. So let's talk about what we came to talk about tonight. And that is, I want to introduce you to the land of Israel, and then I want us to use the information that we learned when we're talking about this, and then go look at a Bible story that I'm sure we've read 100 times, but hopefully this time we'll look at it in a little different light. Let's talk about the land of Israel at a very, very high level. During the time of the Bible, most of the people who lived on the earth lived within the confines of this map. Not all of them, but most of them did. And so what you have here is Europe in the top left, you have Asia in the top right, and of course you have Africa down in the bottom right. Now when God made his promise to Abraham, he said, "I will give you a land." Now God is God. He couldn't have given them any land on the face of the earth. So why did God give them this small 40-mile wide piece of land right here? I don't know. I'm not God. But I like to think about things like that and try to ask questions like that. But if you look to the west of that piece of land, what you have is the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, during the time of the Bible, there was naval activity on the sea, but you couldn't move huge groups of people across the water. To the east of here, what you have, this is all desert. Again, maybe a few people could go across there, but you cannot move large groups of people across there. Just not possible. And so if you lived here and you need to go from Europe or Asia down to Africa, there was only one path, and that is right down this 40-mile wide piece of land. It became a land bridge between three countries, three continents. Millions and millions of people migrated through this land. And so maybe the reason God gave them this land is to say, "You know what? I'm going to put you right here at the crossroads of the world. So that when people came through here, they would see your crops. And they would see all of you, and they would say, 'How are you blessed this way?' And then that would give you the opportunity to tell them about Jehovah. Tell them about me." And in doing so, knowledge of Jehovah God could be spread throughout the known world as they came through there. Again, I don't know, but that just seems logical to me. But now let's take a closer look at this small piece of land here. There we go. And this land, it is very small. I mean, if you take the area from Dan to Beersheba, which we read about in the Bible a good bit, and kind of plot that on a map of Alabama, it would be about the size of the northwest corner. If you took I-65 down to Birmingham, over to the Mississippi line, up the Mississippi line and the Tennessee line, that whole area would fit in the northwest corner of Alabama. It's an extremely small piece of land. And so let's take a closer look at it. The land is actually divided into geographical zones that go from north to south. Starting over here on the far western sidings, you have a coastal plain. About 10 to 12 miles wide, as you would expect, very flat. Mediterranean Sea's on one side. The hills start to encroach a little bit on the eastern side. Cities such as the five cities of the Philistine Pentapolis were in there. Joppa was on the coastal plain. Caesarea from the New Testament was all part of the coastal plain. Coming to the east, what you have is the hill country. Whereas the coastal plain is flat, the hill country has high hills. Extremely deep valleys. It's amazing how deep some of these valleys are. But a lot of the hills throughout the hill country rise nearly 3,000 feet in elevation. So this is where you have cities like Hebron, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Shiloh, even going up into Lower Galilee, this is where Nazareth is. And so this is what you have there. Going on to the east, again, you have the Jordan Rift Valley. Now, everything that you see here on the map that I've highlighted brown with the Jordan Rift Valley is below sea level. The Kidron Valley is about 700 feet below sea level, below the surface of the Mediterranean Sea. Of course, then you have the Jordan River that flows from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, the lowest point on the face of the earth, at minus 1,350 feet below sea level. But this valley itself is only about 8 or 9 miles wide. I mean, obviously, I showed you some pictures this morning from Jericho. You can easily see across this valley. And of course, farther east than that, what you have is the Trans-Jordan Plateau. This is the area that's actually in modern-day Jordan. That's very flat. From the Jordan Rift Valley, the land rises dramatically and flattens off across the whole plateau. Now, if you notice carefully, there's a couple of little areas that I missed. One of them is the Jezreel Valley. Knowing what you now know about the hill country, you can see why the Jezreel Valley is so important. The Jezreel Valley allowed for east-west passage through the land. There's only a couple of places in which you can get across the land, east to west. By far the easiest is the Jezreel Valley. Cities like Megiddo. Megiddo sits on the southern side of the Jezreel Valley, about right there. And so if you think about that, knowing what we know now about the people that are going in this direction, through the land, between the continents, and then going this way, through the land, going east-west, now you know why Megiddo is so strategically important. Megiddo has been captured, rebuilt, and torn down over 23 times throughout history. And that's because if you control Megiddo, you control all access through the land. Pharaoh Thutmose III one time said, capturing Megiddo is like capturing 1,000 cities. Because that's how important it was. The other area down here is down here toward the bottom to the south, and it's called the Shephelah. Shephelah is a Hebrew word. A lot of times in our English Bibles, it's translated the word lowlands. It was near the time of the United Kingdom, it was a small barrier region between the Philistines who lived in the coastal plain and the Israelites who lived in the hill country. There are five valleys that bisect the Shephelah. And this is where a number of the events we read about during the time of the United and the Divided Kingdom took place. So, with that being said, I want you to do a mental exercise with me. What I want to do is I want us to cut the land in half and then lay it on top. And in doing so, we can look at an elevation profile of the land. And so what you have is the Mediterranean Sea over here and the coastal plain. And then, of course, the land rises dramatically into the hill country. Before going back down into the Jordan Rift Valley, see this is lower than the Mediterranean Sea, before going back up to the Trans-Jordan Plateau. Now, having terrain like this in such a small area causes some very interesting weather phenomena. Now, here's a little secret. I'll tell you a little bit about that. I went, as most of you know, went to Bible school, then went down to Florida College for a few years, then went to Florida State University. And while I was there, I got a degree in meteorology. More than that, I married a wife who has a degree in meteorology. And so, yes, we've had the web show on a good bit this week. And so, anytime we get the chance to talk about weather, we like to talk about weather. So let's talk about weather for a second. Very interesting weather phenomenon happens in this area of the country because of the terrain. Most of the time what you have are warm, moist air that blows in off the Mediterranean Sea. And if you've ever watched the sky around here near the summertime, you know, if warm, moist air rises, and which it would do as soon as it hits the mountains, it condenses, forms clouds, and once those raindrops get big enough, it rains. And it rains, and the hill country gets a lot of rain. We'll talk about that in just a second. But as that air keeps going on to the east, it goes down into the valley where it warms, and then immediately dries up. And so the area in the Jordan River Valley doesn't get very much rain. So let's compare a couple places. What about Jerusalem? I mentioned that Jerusalem is at the very top of the hill country. It's about 2,700 feet in elevation. And Jerusalem gets 26 inches of rain per year. Well, how much is that? Well, let's compare it to a city that we all know, and that is London. Now, London, it rains all the time. It rains all the time in London. Here's another little secret about it. My favorite movie of all time is Sound of Music. My second favorite movie is Mary Poppins. I guess I'm a movie fan. Anyway, but Julie Andrews, Mary Poppins, when she showed up at the Bounce House in London, what did she have? She had two things. What did she have? That's right, a carpet bag and an umbrella. Why did she need the umbrella? It always rains in London. It's always raining in London. Well, London gets about 28 inches of rain per year. You realize that Jerusalem gets almost as much rain as London does? But you don't think about it like that. Most of the area of Israel, anything from north of the Negev, is very lush. In fact, by the time you get up to Galilee, in some ways, it's a utopia. It's so beautiful. Green, waterfalls, rivers. It's just beautiful up there. But you don't think about it like that. So what you have here is Jerusalem sitting at the very top of the hill country, gets 26 inches of rain per year. Jericho sits in the 850 feet below sea level. And they get about 4 to 5 inches of rain per year. Now, as the crow flies between Jerusalem and Jericho, that's about 12 miles. 12 miles. So try to think of a place that's 12 miles to the east of you, probably Madison. Now, imagine if Madison was 3,500 feet in elevation lower than where we are right here. And in addition, we get 5 times as much rain as Madison does. It's so striking, the difference that you have here with weather and the rainfall. It's amazing the difference in just 12 miles. The hill going from Jerusalem to Jericho is steep. When you're driving up it, you know, your ears are popping. I mean, you're gaining elevation fast. And so it really is striking. So, with all of this, in our minds, framed in our minds, before we lose it, I want us to open our Bibles and look at the story here. Let's look at the story from 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter. While you're trying to sunset this up, we're closing in on the end of the period of the judges. And the people have asked Samuel to give them a king. And he has anointed Saul, and Saul is starting to begin his reign. And there's a problem up at Jabesh-Gilead. And Saul and the army, they go up there and they take care of the problem in Jabesh-Gilead. And now they're making their way back. And they stop in Gilgal. And when they get to Gilgal, Samuel has something he wants to say to them. Now, we don't know the exact location of Gilgal. Remember this morning I showed you a picture of Jericho, and we said we know exactly where that is, because here's the ruin. Gilgal isn't like that. It was not a fortified city like Jericho is, so there's not as many ruins. But it was a couple of miles, probably to the northeast of where Jericho is, down in the Jordan River Valley. And so, what we have here is Samuel who wants to talk to people here at Jabesh Gilead. And so, let's begin in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 12. And Samuel said to all of Israel, "Behold, I have obeyed your voice in all that you have said to me, and have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you, and I am old and great. And behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Of whose donkey have I taken? Of whom or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you." And they said, "You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hand." And he said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand." And they said, "He is witness." So what Samuel's doing here is he's saying, "Listen, I got something important I want to tell all of you. But before I do, I want to make sure you're going to listen to me." As parents, we do that too. I'm talking about kids. We want to make sure they're listening to us before we tell them something. And he says, "Is there anyone out there that has anything against me?" And of course, they all come out and say, "No, there's not anything against me." He says, "Okay, I'm going to continue." Verse 6. Samuel said to the people, "The Lord is witness who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them, then your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God. And he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the armies of Hazor, and into the hands of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab. And they fought against them. They cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies that we may serve you.' And the Lord sent Zerubbabel and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you live in safety." So it starts off by saying, I want to give you a little history lesson. Do you remember what has happened to you over the last several decades, the last several years? You came into the land, God was with you. But what did you do? You rejected God. Over and over and over and over again. But guess what? Every time you did that, and you prayed to God, and God delivered you. Over and over and over. God has always been there for you. That's your history lesson. Now, keep reading. Verse 12. "And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king.' And now behold the king you have chosen, for whom you have asked. Behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and will not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if you both and your king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandments of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king." So what he's saying here is, despite everything that's happened, despite everything that God has done for you, time and time and time and time again, you rejected God again and asked for him. But with that being said, even though God has put a king up there, you still have a chance. If you and the king do what you're supposed to do and obey God, all will be well. But if you don't, there'll be problems. And so Samuel concludes with these last three verses here. Verse 16. "Now therefore stand still and see the great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. And you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord, in asking for yourselves a king." So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, And all of the people greatly feared the Lord and sang.
Incredible story to hear.
And so I read this and I ask, why did this event have such a profound impact on the people? Why did it say that the people feared the Lord and sang? Why did it have such a profound impact on them? Well, I think of three reasons. First of all, God had made thunder and rain. It's that simple. I mean, can you imagine what this would have looked like? Samuel's talking to these people. He's telling them everything he wants to tell them. And he says, listen, to show you that I'm serious, he asked the Lord for thunder and rain. And it immediately begins to thunder and rain. I mean, think about how that would impact you if you stood there and watched that happen right in front of your eyes. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why they reacted the way they did. The second reason has to do with the fact that God had not only made it thunder and rain, He had made it thunder and rain in a place that rarely gets thunder and rain. Remember what we learned a little while ago about Jericho? Gilgal is very close to Jericho. They get 4 to 5 inches of rain per year. And when they do get rain, it's not like this. It's not heavy rain that we have like Prince of the Thunder. So not only had God made thunder and rain, but He had made thunder and rain in a place that rarely gets thunder and rain. But I think there's one more reason why this had such a profound effect on people. But I need to tell you a little bit more first. Did you notice this question in here? Is it not the wheat harvest today? That's such an odd question, and it seems to have nothing to do with what Samuel's talking about. It seems that way because we live in the and not in the Is it not the wheat harvest today? When is the wheat harvest? Well, let's look at this. I'm going to show you a little bit. Geeks coming out into here. I'm going to show you a graph here. And what you have here are the months of the year down here at the bottom, January, February, March, April, May, all the way across. And over here you have numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And what I want to show you is how the rain falls in Israel every year. This is how the rain falls in Jerusalem every year. We read in the Bible how God sends the land, the early rains and the latter rains. God still does that. The early rains fall in October to November. The latter rains fall in March to April to early May. Between the time of May and October, Jerusalem gets no rain. Zero. The first trip I led over there was actually in June. And a couple weeks prior to the trip, people would call me and ask me, so what do I need to take as far as rain gear? I said, nothing. And they said, well, I need some sort of smarter meteorologist saying that. And it may be. But the truth of the matter is it hasn't rained in Israel in June in millennia. Several millennia. And it's probably not going to this year. And of course it didn't. It never rains in Israel between May and October. This is the distribution for Jerusalem. What about Jericho? Well, it's the exact same, but just lesser amounts, obviously, because they don't get as much rain. So when is the wheat harvest? The wheat harvest is in June. Why did this event have such a profound impact on the people? God had made it thunder and rain. God had made it thunder and rain in a place where it rarely thunders and rains. And finally, God had made it thunder and rain at a place where it rarely rains at a time of year in which it never rains. And the people feared the Lord the same. You understand how worthy of a little bit about the geography and the climate of Israel. Helps you understand the Bible stories a little more. It's such an amazing thing. Learning about this story helps provide context for the Bible. And that's what we want to do for the rest of this week. Thank you so much for your patience tonight. I want to extend an invitation. And then we'll sing an invitation song. And then afterwards, I'll be happy to ask some questions. Sometimes we sing a song, little kids sing a song, church will be singing this. And the song is, "My God is so big, so strong and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do." And that's true. God can make it rain. Wherever he and whenever he needs. And trust me, because he has, we study the weather. That's not an easy thing to do. But our God is a powerful God. And the nice thing about that is our God loves us. He loves you. And he wants you to be the right person. If there's anything we can do tonight to help that, we ask that you come to the front while we stand. Thank you.